So, welcome here. We're going to start off with a presentation about ourselves. So, I'm Tommy Clark, based in Sweden, and I'm a Link MVP for 4 years, I think, 4.5 or something. And I did the MCSM rotation back in May, like the last one there was.
I'm Johan Deleman. I'm from Belgium, third boy from Europe. I'm 6 years MVP and did master rotation in 2012.
Okay, so we promised a level 400 session, so we had to add some snooper diagrams and stuff, and that's it. So that's the invite to you. And. So you should know what to answer to that invite then, because we're going to have a test slide at the end. That's right. Okay. So the agenda is, well,
let's see what I'm doing the agenda. So what we actually want to cover today is not all of this slide, because probably you all know this piece from the workload poster. So if you look at this slide, do you understand everything that's in there? Because it's way too much information. It's like everything together doesn't make sense all the time. We're going to try to make it a little bit easier to take it apart and go through it. We're not only going to do like media stuff, we're also going to do like looking at how conferencing actually works, how it works under the covers, what are the parts and pieces that bring it together. So first of all, we have to start with the protocol. So there is a separate protocol to do all of that conferencing stuff. So obviously, we also have to talk about the backend, whatever is used on the Link servers, what make conferencing possible. Then, of course, modalities. Big piece of that, media, all of that stuff. We're going to cover in modalities, conferencing modalities. And then, of course, conferencing lifecycle. That's also something we need to take into account. And then probably we have some extra slides, which we will probably not be able to cover. We have a second session, a repeat on Thursday, which is 15 minutes longer, so we might be able to cover it then. But anyway, it's in there for you to have more information, so feel free to use it. So first of all, we go into the protocol being used in conferences. So do you all know this protocol? Who knows it? So a few hands, so that's okay. So we're here to explain that. So the protocol is actually called Centralized Conferencing Control Protocol. So CCCP, C3P, which you will also see in a lot of information. So what is it actually? So it's something Microsoft created. It's not something in the open like standard. It's something Microsoft created, and it's important because you use it to do creation, manipulation, and deletion of conferences. But you need to use it if you want to interop with Microsoft conferencing. Like video systems need to understand C3P unless, or they will not be able to join conferences. So it's very important, this protocol. So how are the clients signaling this protocol to the server? Well, they're not actually talking C3P to the server directly. They're actually using SIP to send C3P messages. So if you do a snooper, you will see all these messages come by, just like you do regular troubleshooting in Link. So you will see them in the snooper tools. Then, of course, we use normal SIP messages to transport, like, for example, notify, be notify is used to warn users there's something going on in the conference. For example, a user joined, that will be a notify, and there will be a C3P package in there. Now, how is this configured? It's an XML package. So all the information is in XML transported over SIP. So this is an example. Is it big enough? I think so. So this is an example, and we see, yeah, it's just a SIP message. Because we see we have a start line. It just says service. So it's a SIP message. So, and we're actually talking to, if you look at opaque app, colon, conf, colon, focus factory. This is the conferencing backend. So we're talking SIP to the conferencing backend, and we are sending this, and we see the content type is obviously CCCP, so it's XML. And then we have the body inside here with add conference, for example, as the command we are sending to the conferencing server. So there are several commands, like creating, modifying, deleting, getting conference capabilities, because if you want to schedule a meeting, you need to know what are your capabilities. Am I able to do audio, video, that kind of stuff? What are the URLs? Then, of course, we can get our conferences, like the list of conferences we already scheduled. So we can do some stuff there. And, of course, we need to check if the MCU types are available, because maybe not everything is configured on the server side. Potentially some MCUs are not running, or they're not available, or not configured. So then there are other messages we can send, like we add users to a conference, we delete users, we modify some endpoints. For example, lobby access is also controlled by C3P and all the other stuff. And then I give back the word to Tommy.
So we started with the C3P stuff because that's the protocol being used in the back end. And I'm not meaning the back end database, but the back end servers and everything. And that's the focus and the focus factory. And I think that most of the people that know the C3P stuff knows what a focus and focus factory is, or is that news to, who knows what the focus and focus factory is? Okay, good. So basically, the focus is authenticating participants before allowing them to enter the conference. And it's also managing the conference states, and it's maintaining and enforcing the conference's policies and the rules. And it's allowing the organizer to change the meeting during the meetings, so like locking the meeting in the mid-meetings. And the focus factory is a SIP entity that creates and modifies and deletes the conference in the conferencing database backend, that is. And the clients use a SIP service message to send a C3P command to and from the focus factory. So it's basically the focus factory that's are responsible for scheduling the meeting in the backend database. And after it's scheduled, it will also send back the meeting URI to the user. And that would be the Outlook client or the web page that you can schedule meetings from. The MCU factory is also called conferencing factory in some technical documentations and blog posts. And it runs on each front-end server as an application and uses HTTP as the interface to talk to. And it's responsible for provisioning the conference for a particular media type on the conference server. So it's basically provision the meetings according to the policies and takes into account the load on the conferencing server before assigning the conference to a particular server. So the MCU factory will check with the backend database what kind of load there is on the different front-end servers before it provisions the meeting on one of these servers. The conferencing database is the RTC local database on the primary front-end for the user, and it will use WinFabric to synchronize the information to the two secondary members after it stores that information in the RTC local database then. The conferencing database contains the metadata for the conference, but not the calendar information that is stored in Exchange. It also talks to the backend database, the conferencing server talks to the backend database to get this conferencing load information. How many of you have seen this slide before? So This is basically the life cycle of a conference, and we will get back to this later on when we talk about life cycle. And this in particular is the way that the conference is scheduled and managed when the assigned conferencing type is set to false. And that means that the Outlook client is online and the Lync client is logged in. And you can actually schedule a meeting when you are offline, and Johan will talk about that later on. So this is the online version of a schedule and a Lync meeting. The first step is the client, and that would be Outlook in this case, that talks to the focus factory and when you want to create a meeting. So that's basically what the user sees. The second part would be the focus factory talking to the backend database and writing the information there, and then returns the SIP URI to the client. And number three is the conferencing client talking to the focus over here. And that's basically when you join or creates the conference or activates the conference. And that would be an invite dialogue from the client to the focus. And that invite is used for the client to communicate with the server, and it sends command traffic in there. So, and it's also a subscribe and notify dialogue that it connects with to get conference state information, like who joins and who gets kicked out and who is muted and so on. The fourth part would be the focus that connects to the backend database to retrieve the conferencing record and to make sure that the client is allowed to enter the meeting. And there's also some policies like if the client should be muted and so on, that gets stored in its database. After that, the focus will talk to the MCU factory and asks where it should start this meeting. Like I told before, like if one of the different front-end servers are under a heavy load, it can put the meeting on a different server. And the MCU factory will ask the conferencing server for if it's possible to start the meeting over there. And if it says that it is because of the load things, it will send back the HTTP URL for the meeting to the focus. And at the eighth step, the client will connect using that URL. So that's basically what's happening when we scheduling joining a meeting. Yeah. Could you repeat that? It will try to create a meeting on the primary front end that you are registered to. But after that, if that one is under heavy load, it will select another one for that, basically. And we will talk more about this during the conference lifecycle session, or not session, but part of this session later on. This slide is only to represent how the different protocols and what kind of traffic are being sent from the Lync client or some USEMA clients down here to the focus and through the different MCUs over there. So it's basically audio over SRTP, and we could also see that it's talking C3P between the focus and the MCUs to decide on different stuff. Modalities.
So now we're moving on to modalities. So what can we use during a conference? So we all know, obviously, that there are different modalities like instant messaging, audio, video, application sharing, and data conferencing. So we go through all of them and dig a little bit deeper how it really works. So if you're a PowerShell guru, you can do a one-liner and get the conference states. Like, for example, you could do get CS Windows Service and then look at MCU. And then you will have a list of every MCU available and the concurrent sessions currently going on. So first of the modalities we're going into is IM conferencing. So IM is essentially SIP. So we're not doing any fancy stuff there except SIP. So it's still SIP signaling and easy to troubleshoot with Snooper if you want. Going a little bit deeper. So IM conferencing, so it's called RTC IM MCU because there's a separate service running on the box and the name has SVC extra added to the service name and you can get it with this command. So if you want to focus on this conferencing server only, you can focus on with this command. So this is like a build-up for all the modalities, a little bit similar for all modalities we are doing now. And for example, we are going to explain some features and what's the value, the default value, for example, and then what can you do to configure some stuff and maybe some nodes additionally added to that. So for example, how to start IM. Does instant messaging start automatically when you join a conference? That's a good question. Does anyone know that? It doesn't actually start automatically because in 2013 we have just the audio part. We don't have the instant messaging window by default. So it doesn't do that. For example, can we disable IM? Yes, we can do that, but not for long because it was only from cumulative update October 2013 that we had an option to disable IM in a conference. Or there was another option like Q&A. If you enable Q&A, it will turn off IM. Because it's sometimes it's annoying if you're in a large meeting and everyone is typing, you get the ping-ping sound all the time. If you want to make sure that doesn't happen, switch to Q&A or disable IM. One interesting thing I found while testing and preparing the session was, can you do an IM-only meeting? I was expecting not to work, but it works. So you can do an IM-only meeting. I had customers requesting this in Link 2010, and I know it didn't work then. Apparently, it does work now. And because of that, we deployed persistent chat, which was even worse. But you can do IM-only meeting, so that's good. And of course, Q&A is available as well. So some screenshots to go with that. So when you're scheduling a meeting, you have the option to say, I want to disable IM in this meeting. So that's easy, right? And then you can configure some policies. Do we allow Q&A, yes or no? So by default, this is enabled. So you can switch to Q&A if you want to. So for example, if we disable IM, this is the experience. So you will join the meeting, but it will say, OK, IM is disabled. So we know that. And for example, how do we enable Q&A? So currently a meeting is going on and we want to change it to a Q&A meeting because we cannot set a Q&A meeting up front. We have to do it during the meeting or when a presenter joins, he switches to Q&A. So we go into the client and we go to the share screen and then we just click on Q&A, it's enabled. So and then we see this interface, so people can ask questions, but they're not in the IM window. So we have to do Q&A so presenters can answer questions there. So how do we join an IM conference? So that essentially it's very easy, it's just SIP, we do an invite. So we invite, and where do we send the invite to? So if you look very close, like in Opaque, again, we have AppConf, chat ID and then the conference ID. So we are connecting to the conferencing server, so the IM conferencing server, and we give, and we say, okay, for this conference, so we give the ID as well. we're going to join it. So we invite it into, or we invite it to go into the conference. So it's from a user account to the conference, the instant messaging conferencing server. And what content type is there? So usually when you do an invite, and we will see it in audio and video, you will have SDP. So SDP is session description protocol, for those who don't know that. It's like, how do we negotiate media streams? So like IP addresses and ports to be used during a session. Of course, for IM, it's kind of strange to have IPs and port ranges. So essentially, what we're doing is sending an empty SDP message. Because it says, well, it only says M from media. It says it's a message. So we'll see later on there are some different options when you do audio or video or something. So essentially, it's an empty SDP. So it's still SIP, and we join it with an empty SDP. So then, for example, if we send a message during a conference, we just use the message SIP start line. And then, of course, it's against the same server with the same ID for the conference. And then the content type is essentially whatever we are typing in the message, not being seen here because it's deleted for the, when you do tracing, it's not in there. So then we move on to audio video conferencing server, which essentially is audio and video combined, but we split it up like a little bit of audio and then a little bit of video later with a joint, with a start covering both stuff. Like for example, what is it? Is the RTC AV MCU. Of course, the separate service. And you can get the information from PowerShell if you want to, how many sessions are going on, if you run this command. So again, we go over the same thing, like what features can we do and how can we tweak it. So for example, do we auto-start a meeting with audio? Of course, that's the main reason we do meetings. So audio always starts. Can we disable it? Can we disable audio? I was thinking that would not be possible to do meetings without audio, but essentially you can do it, an IM only meeting. So you can do it, but you have to do it in, for example, a conference policy. So it's configured in a policy that you can, it's a user policy, so you apply the user policy to any user, so maybe those users cannot do an audio conference and the others can do an audio conference. Let's see what's also important here. Okay, we can obviously mute participants, specific participants. We can do an audio-only meeting because we can disable all the other modalities. And then, for example, for video, video can also be disabled. We cannot have video-only meetings. So video-only meetings will never work because you need audio to go with video. What? Sign language?
You have to mute the microphone.
Well, essentially, you're not sending any packets over the wire anyway, so you're just doing comfort noise. So it's not a problem for the network, but, well, video is potentially.
Can you do polling?
What?
Can you do polling during conference, like get user input, ask a question, yes, no kind of polling?
Yeah.
Oh, polls.
Yeah.
Okay, we're not really covering polls. That's piece of the web conferencing piece. But you can essentially do that. You can create a poll, post it for everyone. They can enter their details or their choices, and then you can display it to the users. But that's in there for a long time already. I think from OCS. Well, live meeting it was. So if you look, how do we do this? Disable audio and video. So obviously we have the conferencing policies with the options allow IP audio, allow IP video, which we can also do from the control panel, but we are all PowerShell guys, so we like to do it from PowerShell. And for example, if your IP audio and IP video is disabled, you still can schedule meetings, which I also didn't expect, but you can schedule meetings, although it removes everything from dial-in conferencing. So normally there should be dial-in conferencing numbers and stuff like that, but if audio and video are disabled, or audio is disabled, you will not have this information, but you will have the join link. And what will happen is you just click the link, and essentially what happens is that it tries to connect to audio, it comes back, but IAM is still there. It doesn't give you a failure, but it's a kind of strange. It tries to connect to audio first, and then just comes back, and there's no problem. Well, if you don't have audio, then it's like this. Or, for example, you can say, I don't want to join the audio piece on the client when you're joining. That's also something you can do during joining a session. So how can we mute audio and video also during scheduling time? So we have both options, like we are going to mute all attendees when they're joining the conference, and we want to block all the video. Obviously, you can also do that during a meeting. So during a meeting, we can say, okay, we are going to mute everyone, and we are going to block, or we don't allow video anymore. So we have two options. And then we go into some other options you have to configure the audio conferencing piece. For example, an important one is actually the third one, allow multi-video view, allow multi-view. It's a per organizer policy. So that means users can organize meetings that enable multi-video view, yes or no. And the one under that specifies whether a specific user can join a conference with multi-video view. So there's a big difference between organizer policies and end user policies or attendees joining. Apparently, the max video conferencing resolution for VGA, for example, which is default, has been deprecated, so Link 2013 doesn't use that policy anymore. So if you want to tweak it a little bit, you do have some options. For example, total received video bit rate, you can specify that. So default, you see the default values, that's 50 megabytes per second or megabits per second. So that's pretty high. And it really means all the streams combined. So all the video streams combined, that value you can limit. It is separate from call at mission control, if you know call at mission control, to regulate your network traffic. So it's a separate from that. And of course, you can also specify the amount of network bandwidth you're going to send to the conferencing server.
Excuse me, I've never tried this before, but can you enable dial-in just for audio and turn off audio from the link client?
I don't think so. Not sure, I don't think you can do that. Or maybe, does anyone know? I don't think so. So now we're going into more like the details, what is audio all about. For example, the audio conferencing server does mixing. So mixing is very different from switching. So video will be doing switching, audio is mixing. So they're a very different approach for conferencing. So it will mix all speakers into a single stream, and it's up to 5 active speakers being mixed within a single stream. So what actually happens is that the conferencing server, so you can have clients which have different codecs connecting to the server, and potentially a client does not have the same codec going up or going down. Potentially you have an asynchronous network connection, for example, ADSL or something. Potentially you have other codecs going on there. So you have different clients joining an audio meeting. And of course, the server has to take into account all these different codecs and mix them together, because I've put in a mixer here, and send it out back to the clients. So essentially what the audio conferencing server is doing is like there are several streams going into the conference. Of course, yeah, up to 5 active speakers. And we have to decode those streams, so it will take up some CPU cycles. So if you look at scale, It's important to know, to understand what codecs you can use in conferencing, because not all codecs are optimized for conferencing. But we have to decode them, and then we mix them, and then send them back to the clients. But we have to re-encode them, again, some CPU cycles, but we have to strip. If we're talking to a conference, we have to strip our own stream, of course, because we don't want to hear ourselves. So there's some other stuff going on as well. So the audio conferencing server is doing quite a lot of work. So that's sent to all attendees. So if you look a little bit closer to the RTP and the codecs, so this is the list from MSDN, but I'm going to show you the SDP, whatever is negotiated between clients. So this is the list available, and for example, clock rates and P times are important. Like clock rates means 8,000 hertz sampling rate, that means you have a narrow band codec, 16,000 hertz sampling, that's wide band codec. And of course, P times are important. If you have a slow connection or a long delays, then you probably are going to switch between codecs. Because if you look at Siren, for example, it can go from 20 until 200. And P times means like how much milliseconds do we have time for audio packets to arrive. So it can switch the delay or the buffer when we receive audio packets. So if we have a bad network, most likely we're going to use Siren. So this is essentially a capture I took from a link client connecting to a conference and then stripping out all the unimportant stuff and keeping only the audio codecs. So if you don't really know SDP, I'm going to a little bit explain it, how it works. But essentially, M is audio. That means, OK, the modality is audio. And then whatever we see the values at the end with the arrow, so there's a priority. So 117 is higher priority than 114 and all the way until the end. So and then we see all the other codecs or the codecs listed in beneath. But doesn't it look very strange to you? So if the first codec is the highest priority, doesn't it look strange to you, something? Like, we have 8,000 hertz sampling. So it should be narrowband codec, right? So I was like, that can't be right. What's happening there? I did a little bit of digging around, and I found some RFC. And essentially, someone made a mistake and put 8,000 there instead of 16. So it essentially is a wideband codec, but it's like wrongly configured. And it needs to be like this forever because it's an RFC and we cannot change it. It's with backward compatible. So I was a little bit afraid, like, how is this possible? Narrowband, more priority than wideband. But essentially now it makes sense. So it's wideband, and then at the end we do the narrowband stuff. And CN actually means comfort noise.
What's the red?
Excuse me?
What's red?
Red is actually, yeah, I'm going through all of them. Well, most of them. So you see some other codecs therein as well. So for example, the XMSRTA, that's the RT audio codecs, so both narrowband, wideband. And of course there's a strange one, Silk. Does anyone know what Silk is? Indeed, so it's Skype. So it's in there already. I'm not sure if they're using it right now, potentially in the future, I don't know. But it's in there right now. So we can see it clearly in the SDP. It's not hidden from us, it's in there. So and then red is actually the codec used when we have drop packets and then we have to send more packets because the forward error correction kicks in, then usually red is being used. Then of course we have the PCMU and PCMA, the G711 codecs, well known in voice over IP. So then we look at how do we join an audio conference. So again, it's SIP, it's a SIP invite, but now we're not sending it to an IM server, but we're sending it to the audio and video conferencing server with specific ID. And of course, we look at whatever we are sending, and then we know, okay, this is an SDP. We are going to send audio or request audio to connect. And then we have the list of codecs available and the candidates or the ports and the IP addresses we have to connect to. And then, of course, the codecs. So, and then we look at what codecs does the client offer and what codec does the server offer. So this is the list we went over like a few minutes ago. And then this is what the server returns to the client. So there are less codecs available. So if you look what's not available in the conferencing server, then we see these codecs are not available. So RT Audio, Silk, and some other. So potentially you would say that's kind of strange. So the Microsoft codec is not used in conferences. We all know it's an optimized codec. Why won't you use it? Because it's not processor friendly. Of course, if you have to do encoding, re-encoding, decoding, of course, if you do need a lot of CPU cycles, that's not very good. So it leaves out a lot of those other codecs. And then if you then look at the reinvite, then we can find out whatever IP and port combinations are used and whatever codec is available. So and then we will see that, so this is the same from before, and in the reinvite, we have even fewer codecs. So essentially, we don't have the G722-8000/2 codec. Anyone know what the codec is?
Stereo
codec. So it's only used for link room systems. So we don't use it for our regular clients. So I've not tested with link room system, of course. So if you have a room system, then obviously it will use the codec if you have stereo mics.
So if
there are two room systems.
Well, no. It will always send it to the server if it's configured on the room system, because you have to configure it on the room system to send the stereo codec. And essentially, the link client will be able to listen to that codec, but the link client will not send stereo because there's no real use in sending that.
Yeah. So basically, you need to use it.
So and this is just an example. It's not like one fit for all, so it can vary depending on scenarios, of course. Obviously, link room system is one of them. So if you then go look at whatever codec we're using at a certain time, you can do that with Network Monitor, because we're in Microsoft Conference, we're not using Wireshark. And I like Network Monitor, because you can see what IP addresses you send traffic to, and then, I really like it. I really do. So, but whatever you can see in Network Monitor, it's like, you see there, 80.0.9.7.4, that's like, okay, very cryptic. But luckily, you can decode it. So you select it and you say decode as, and then you say RTP, and then it says, okay, we're using this codec. So it's G722, 8000 hertz. So, and I wanted to do a demo like switching the codecs dynamically, but of course my servers are in Europe and the delay is a little bit high, so I'm using Siren all the time. I can't show it, but you get the idea, right? So now we look at what is the conference flow, like the media streams and the port ranges. So obviously, if we click a join link, potentially we open the browser, so we do HTTPS to the reverse proxy. Also from an internal client, so we have external clients, internal clients. And then we connect over SIP, so we connect to the servers, because we are going to do an invite or connecting to the conference over SIP. So we know if you're an external user, it's going to be 443. And then we signal 5061 to the server. Internally, it's 5061. I'm sorry too. Didn't work. So, if you are sending media to the to the media server, the conferencing server. Obviously, as an external client, we are going to use port UDP 3478, sending it to the Edge server. And then Edge, it's not Edge going, well, you know all the I stuff. So you know the firewall rules are not like the arrow from Edge, but essentially media is flowing to that site. So we are going to send it to the port range on the server side. So the port range on the server side is from 49152 until 57500. So it's a large port range, like over 8,000 ports. And then, of course, a second stream is going to the client. And then, of course, we're sending to the Edge server over port 3478. And then, depending on client configuration, so this is default client configuration, it will use port 1024 until the upper range. So 64K port range by default. You can change that, but by default it's like this. So and internally we just connect to the server and then also the 64K port range like this. Then of course if we also are doing dial-in conferencing, we're going to do the media between the conferencing server and the mediation server. It will use the same port range on both servers. And then, of course, if you look at whatever is happening on mobile clients, so an external mobile client connects to the reverse proxy, of course, to signal and to do all of that stuff. But our internal clients also need to connect to the external site for reverse proxy. We all know this. But the media, and then the reverse proxy connects to 4443, and then the media flows like essentially the same as the fixed client. So no surprise there. Any questions? Okay. So now we dive a little bit in video details. So remember, there's a difference. It's video switching, not video mixing. That would require a high CPU, like what legacy systems essentially do. So we all know we have this H.264 codec, SVC, developed together with Polycom and others. And RTVC1, essentially the legacy codec for Link, is RT video. Link 2010 still uses this codec only. And then H.263, everyone know H.263? So that's even more legacy, very, very low detail. So whatever OCS used in the early days was this codec, essentially. So if you look at the SDP, it's not like in audio we have a long, long, long list. In video, we only have three options. So the first option is the default one. It's like SVC, whatever Link 2013 is using. And then we have the legacy codec, fallback, or because the Link 2013 client can connect to 2010 as well. And we can still have 2010 clients. And then the last one is essentially the forward error correction codec, which will be used when you have a bad network connection. So it's video switching. That means it has a little bit of impact on the network. And I strongly suggest to join Jeff from Polycom. He has a good session on this. What are you doing with my network? Which will probably explain this a little bit better. But like, we'll have a short overview how this a little bit works. So essentially, we have the multi-video view. So for example, the web interface or everyone on your right is using multi-video view. And for example, there are two users just not doing multi-video view or not allowed to do that. So if they, for example, decide to go full screen, then of course we have to send an extra stream because they're requesting a video resolution and codec, or yeah, not codec, but video resolution not being offered currently. So the clients have to send whatever the other clients are requesting from the server. So you see a lot of streams there. So potentially you can do something with your network. You can bring it down. So a little bit careful there. So of course it's video switching, and then there are so many video streams coming into the server, and whatever we are requesting, the server will send. So for example, if you just join by default a multi-video view meeting, it's not full screen enabled. is just window size. So we are going to do 24p, and then of course we need 5 streams. So it will be 5 24p streams. So other clients need to send those streams. So if we go, for example, add meeting content, then of course the video sizes will be smaller. Then we are only requesting 180p, 5 times. And of course, if we only do active speaker, we have 240p, potentially also previous active speaker. And then of course, full screen will be 1080p. And of course, clients need to send this resolution. So if you look what else is happening, because not only resolutions matter, but also network connections. So for example, there are going streams to the conferencing server, and potentially you have many clients requesting that same stream. But maybe they're not all on the same excellent network. Maybe some are on the internet, some are on the LAN. So what the server also will do is, like, it will drop the frame rates if you're not able to get that frame rate. So it will drop from 30 to 15 to 7.5 frames per second. And of course, if someone requests RT video, then someone has to send it to the server. We're not doing the transcoding on the server. Essentially the same with all the others. So you see lots of streams coming into the server and potentially going to all the clients. So, and for example, all these streams, these 4 streams, can originate from the same client. Because he needs to send whatever he needs to send to the server. So, but there's no decoding, no mixing, or encoding. So the same thing, how do we join a video conference? So it's the build-up is always the same. So it's an invite to the audio video conferencing server. It's SDP, and of course we say M is video, so the modality is video, and we have the codecs over here. Then if you look at whatever is happening in media on port ranges on the server side and the client side, I'm not drawing all the other lines, I'm just doing the media now. So of course the client is again sending UDP to the edge server on 3478. It will be sending to the video port range, that's a different port range. It's 57501 until the high port range. And of course the server will send like the same stuff we sent in audio, like port 3478 on edge, and then the 64K port range on the client. And I'm going to hand it over to Tommy.
Yeah, and so after application sharing and the next one, we have a pretty cool demo, and in the interest of time, we might have to speed things up. So application sharing conferencing server is the RTC AS MCU, and it's a separate server that you can restart and stop and manage like all the other servers. And we also have PowerShell to that one. And this command getcs window service is the best command to see what's actually happening on the different servers, I think. Or is there any other good ways to see that? So this is basically live what's happening, and we have one conference active on this one. So with application sharing, we have the different policies that we can set and to manage the meetings, but not so much as the other ones. For example, we can start app sharing only, not. And we have the enable application desktop over there. And we can manage them from inside the client. Johan, you have to help me out.
What?
You have to take over.
Okay.
I'm started from the other one.
From the other one?
Yeah, next one.
Okay. So if you look at the SDPs, whatever application sharing is doing, there's no long list. There's only one codec being sent in the SDPs. And if you look at the last item on the slide, you see media type RDP. So it's essentially RDP in as RTP. So it's also kind of dynamic because we're not sending always the same information. Like if you do a screen refresh, it's like a huge amount of information. And then if you're moving a mouse pointer or something, it's just a few data. So again, the same thing is if we add application sharing, again, we are going to send a SIP invite to the conferencing server, obviously the application sharing conferencing server. And we will see, again, SDP. And we will see that it's modality application sharing. And then, of course, all the codecs, which is only one in this case. We have a few knobs we can do to tweak it. So do we allow users to schedule meetings with application sharing? Because potentially, you know that you can bring down also the network. Because if someone is sharing a video in application sharing, it's like refreshing all the time. And potentially, you're sending like 10 megs to the server and to all clients. So that's a lot. So do we allow it per organizer, yes or no? Do we enable desktop sharing or only app sharing or none of those? So those are the options. And then, of course, we also have the app sharing bit rate, which we can tweak. Like, for example, if we want to limit the burstiness of like screen refresh, yeah, we can limit it. But if you do that, be very careful. User experience will be very bad because we will not be able to send everything or have a good quality. But essentially, you can do a little bit of tweaking here. So if you look at application sharing, again, it's a media stream. So the client is sending, not UDP. Now it's TCP, so there's a difference. So RDP is, in our case, never UDP. So we send 2443 on the edge side. And then, of course, the mediation or the conferencing server needs to connect to 443 on the internal side of edge. And the port range, unfortunately, by default, covers both audio and video at the same time. So we have 16,000 ports or a little bit more. So it's stretched over those port ranges, which is kind of annoying if you want to do quality of service and stuff like that, because then it gets very, messy, I must say. So the internal clients also connect to those port ranges. And if we are doing federated sharing, it's a little bit different. But of course, the application sharing MCU connects to the edge or 443. And it will send to another edge on 443, but it will originate from the high port range, from 50,000 until 59,999. And if you look very closely, there's only one stream. Like if you do audio and video, you have a stream going this way and a stream going that way. If you do application sharing, it's TCP connection, so it flows between the connections.
You have a flow now.
Okay.
I was going to start here, I thought.
So web conferencing, so that's kind of funny. All the others was like IM, AV, AS. So this is data MCU, to make it very clear. But it's just a name. So again, we have a different service. And you can get it, the amount of sessions from PowerShell. Of course, some other stuff here, how to start web conferences. Can we disable it? Yes, you can disable web conferences. We just say enable data collaboration, true or false, in the conferencing policy, so we can enable it for certain users, yes or no. Then we move further. So what other stuff do we have? So we have the complete conferencing policy here, highlighted the enable data collaboration, yes or no. And then specific settings for during a meeting, like do you allow annotations, external users, polls, Q&A, all of that stuff, we configure through policies. That's probably something you already know. One thing that may be a little bit different from the others is when the MCU starts up, so the data conference MCU, it will connect to the edge server all the time at startup. So it's very different from the other modalities. So it also means that there is a persistent connection from the conferencing servers to the edge servers, and that this persistent connection will be shared by all clients and all signaling for PSOC. And of course, it connects to port 8057. We all know that's the PSOM port. So essentially, the server starts up and immediately connects to the edge on this port. And then starting the PSOM session, of course, we are going to connect to 443, but then on the web conferencing IP address, we configure on the edge server and then send all the information. So, of course, the internal clients will connect on 8057. PowerPoint sharing, obviously PowerPoint sharing has changed in Link 2013. You probably already know all of this. So clients connect to HTTPS. So of course they need to have the URL from within the, I think it's from within the C3P package the clients receive from the server, connect to that URL for the PowerPoint. So they will connect to reverse proxy. And the same thing will happen for the mobile clients because they have to come via the external side. And they will connect to the Office WebOps form. And we all know it's 443 on the outside, 443 on the inside. Don't mistake there. And of course, the internal clients will connect internally directly to the Office WebOps server. So our last piece is, or let's see how much time we have. Not sure.
About 15.
21?
It's wrong. 15.
15
something.
So conferencing lifecycle. So scheduling, activation, deactivation, deleting, expiration. So scheduling. So we all know we use, normally we use Outlook. You can do other stuff as well. You can use UCWA if you want to, because you can do it from your own code if you want. But essentially it's the, Tommy explained it already, but it's Outlook connecting to the Focus Factory, sending a service request. And it's, of course, it's a SIP message, but encoded, there's the C3P package, and then the Focus Factory connects to the backend database, and then sends a 200 OK with all the information. So I was trying to do some tests and getting the SIP traces. So when I was doing the scheduling on my PC, I was like, OK, I'm going to trace. I create a meeting, and I go to the traces, and I see nothing. What's happening? So it's, I didn't realize, but apparently. And of course, this goes together with if you have your default conference applied to your default, then some stuff can happen unexpectedly, but essentially it's a good thing. Because if you schedule in Outlook, well, it needs to happen not the first time, because then you will obviously connect to the server, but the conferencing admin client will cache all the information for your default conference. So that's a good thing because we can schedule offline online meetings. Kind of funny, but so that's good.
So go back one slide. And this is basically the setting where you can configure the client to always have the same meeting ID. And if you change this one to false, you will have a new meeting ID for every meeting that you schedule. And so that's basically why we call it offline meeting as well in here. And when we did this test, we also noticed that the default configuration in Link Online is to have this setting set to false. So I always get a new meeting ID for all my meetings. And we couldn't test this the same way as we did when in Yuan's environment.
Yeah, and if Tommy did create a new online meeting and he didn't have any connection, it will fail.
It sets like you have to sign into Link before you configure the schedule the meeting.
So the cache, a good thing, but not good for demos, because if you're not seeing anything, you're not able to explain anything. So. Yeah, you can. Yeah, of course, but if you just schedule a meeting, it's by default your default conference. Then you can go in and change the meeting options, of course. Then you're going to create a new one. I know.
So the default value in Lync on-prem is to have your default meeting. So you always have the same meeting ID. But the default one in the Lync Online is to get a new ID for all your meetings. But you can change them in both Lync on-prem and in Lync Online.
Do you use always the default one? Or apparently in Lync Online, you only have, or every time you create a new meeting, it's a new meeting. It's not your default meeting, apparently.
Yeah. It has tenant ID in the PowerShell command, but I haven't tested it. But you can do the same if you just add the tenant ID against your tenant. So it should be, but I haven't tested it.
Absolutely. You can do that. It's more secure if you do, but by default it's just like it is, it's your default meeting. So it's because it's unsecure, your meeting never expires, it's everyone. Yeah.
And you have the recurring meeting problem
all the time. So if you send it once, people have it and can potentially join your meetings.
And if you're late on the first meeting and people start to join from the second one, they're gonna join to that meeting, so it might be troublesome. And there was one other settings as well, if you go back one slide. The PowerShell command. Okay. The enable assigned conference type. You can also change that one to false and true and play around with that setting.
Yeah, so when doing scheduling the meeting, then you will see that
really?
Yeah.
So is that to say that if you use cache that the backend, so the backend database is never aware that you created that conference if
well,
you're using the cache data?
It already exists.
And if you upload files and stuff, they will be there for all the different meetings as well. Yeah.
So this is a trace of doing a schedule for a default conference. So essentially, we are signaling to the server with a service request. And we are saying, OK, get conference capabilities. So I want to know what are my conferencing capabilities. So the server comes then back and says, OK, I have a response for you. You can do, or those modalities are available. And for example, this is a dial-in URL. We have all the other configuration in here. So essentially receiving all the information from the server. So and then, second step is that we say, I want to get a specific conference. So get conference, and the key is here, like static is true. So the static is my default conference. So I'm getting that static information from the server. And then, of course, I will have all this information in the response. Because we can see the, where's the key? Or the ID. So we can see the ID over here. And then we are going to say, signaling again to the server, we're going to get all the details, I think. Yeah, for example. So that's the flow when you're scheduling a meeting, your default.
And also, a lot of the settings for Link Online is kind of hidden and undocumented for us normal people. So if you enable the client-side logging and open up the log file on the client, you will see all this kind of information and kind of document the stuff backwards. So it's possible to see all the settings in Link Online, but that's the best way of doing it, I think.
We also want to show you, like, you can view whatever is happening in the backend with, does anyone know DB Analyzer? It's a resource kit tool which you can use to get some information, whatever is happening. So I'm going to do a query on the user object. So the server will return all information it has from for a specific user. But that will include everything like contact lists, certificates, meetings, all of that information is returned from the server. So and then we can go look at whatever this user has scheduled. Yeah. Formatting is a little bit bad. Maybe I'll do the view. Yeah. Okay. Are you still able to see this? Okay, so we can have all the information for our user object and also conferences. So we can see there are a lot of conferences currently for a specific user. And when we schedule this, you will see an extra entry in here. Of course, we can also take a specific conference. For example, this one.
So the column to the left is the meeting IDs for all the scheduled meetings that are in the database right now.
The PSTN ID, that I assume that's the dial-in code, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Well, what is this number?
I wouldn't know.
Sometimes people call it, they delete something, they forget what their call number is, you give them this one. It still works, but it's not the same one.
I don't know. So essentially, if you look at this list of conferences, you see there is one marked as true, so that we know this is our default conference or static one. So we can, for example, take a conference ID and then maybe drill down in that specific conference what information we can see. So then we get also a response and we see, for example, when this was scheduled, expiration time, all of that stuff is in here. If it's active, if it's inactive, what organizers, what invitees there were, what MCUs, are there active, inactive? So you can find real the detailed information in here, what's going on in the background. So we'll switch to. Now it's
which
doing
one?
Life cycle.
Where is that? Am I too long?
Yeah, so we included everything so you can view it offline.
Oh, yeah. So in what we just showed you saw that the meeting was inactive, right? Or the MCUs was inactive. And that's basically just a scheduled meeting. And when the first client joins that meeting, it's going to activate the meeting, and it's sending some C3P messages between the focus and the different MCUs and to activate that meeting. And that's basically from that point on that the life cycle times are. So if we schedule a meeting the 1st of March, it's going to be recycled the 15th of March. Is that true? Or 16th? We're having a little bit of time differences between the servers. So it should be 15 days, but it looks like it's kind of 16 day because it's 12 a.m. or something. Yeah.
But when you create it, it's active right then and there, right? So like if you schedule a meeting a year in advance, that meeting's active for a year plus 15 days, right?
Yeah, but it will show you as inactive in on the MCUs that you saw on demos. So it will activate and then kind of deactivate, but it won't recycle or kind of crash everything until it's recycled after 15 days from that time, unless you delete it from Outlook or delete the user. So we're going to show this in a demo instead. Yeah. We have time.
Yeah.
So if we just create a new meeting, like I did before.
Or? Well, I think it's easier if you go
This
way. So whatever happens if we do an ad hoc meeting, so the order of messages sent to the server. So first of all, we already know it's a service message to the server, so in SIP. And of course, there's C3P inside of that. So if we do ad hoc meetings, of course, we need to create first a new meeting. So the first message we are going to send is at conference. And of course, then we get a conference back, and then we're going to invite it because we're going to join it. Ad hoc meetings are scheduled on the fly, and then you just join them directly. So we do an invite, of course, the focus with the ID, and then we're going to add ourselves as a user into the conference. So of course, we are also going to subscribe to the focus. Why we want to do this, we have to do this because we want to be aware if someone joins the conference, so we need to be notified. So we are going to update our roster based on notifications. So of course, if we join a specific meeting, we are going to automatically invite, for example, the chat MCU. And also we get a notification that someone added or joined a specific MCU. Because we see this in the client, right? You see for specific modalities that someone is joined yes or no. For example, yes in audio, not in IM, or yes in IM, not in audio. You see that in the client. So you need to be notified in order to change that. And of course, then we're going to invite the AVMCU as well. And then there's a specific thing, what actually happens on the back of the conference. So it's essentially the server who is going to invite a special user account, which is called CAS. So it's CAS and then your username or your SIP address. And essentially, that's the conferencing announcement service, which takes care of announcing if people are joining or leaving a conference. And of course, we are going to subscribe, or the server is going to subscribe, or the conference announcement service is going to subscribe to the service as well, because he needs to be notified if there's a user, then he will announce it. Not sure anymore what this means. So, of course, we are going to be notified if a user is joining the conference.
And so, conference deactivation, and that's basically when you open up a meeting, you have the red cross in the right corner, and you can end the meeting from over there. And then on the bottom right, you have like three dots, and you can go into that setting and choose end the conference. And it's a bit different how you do that, but if you end the conference, it will send out a deactivation for that meeting, unless it's your default conference, that is. And when you do that, participants will be ejected after 90 minutes, or if they're not signed in users from your organization. So like all the anonymous joined users will be kicked out after 90 minutes. And that time was originally like 10 minutes, but when we checked, so a lot of the documentation says 10 minutes, but when we checked our default configuration, it's like 90 minutes. So, but you might have heard 10 minutes before. When that happens, the conference will send a delete in a CTP message and end the meeting at the focus factory. That also happens if the organizer is disabled or deleted from using a link. So basically, when you delete a meeting from Outlook or if you delete the user. And after that, the meeting will expire after 15 days of grace period, and that will delete all the uploaded slides, the whiteboards, the meeting notes, and so on. And that will be deleted from the presentation file share. This data is encrypted on the file share, and it's kind of hard to find out the specific files for different meetings because it's saved with a long GUID and it's encrypted, so you can't really get to it. And by that, we are at the end.
Show the last slide.
Oh, that's true. No, I haven't seen that either. So, and the last slide is this one. So that's our bye. And